This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. December 7th marks the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, a battle launched by Japan to prevent the U.S. Pacific Fleet from interfering with military actions in Southeast Asia. The two-hour barrage resulted in more than 2,400 American fatalities. 18 naval vessels were damaged or sunk, and over 300 aircraft were damaged or destroyed during the surprise attack on the naval base in Hawaii. To commemorate the day that will live in infamy, the Wayne County Public Library is presenting a lecture recounting the battle and the effect it had on Wayne County residents who survived it. Mac McKee today speaks with local history librarian at the Wayne County Library, Marty Cheddar, about the program happening on Wednesday.
How did you come up with the idea for this particular presentation for the commemoration of Pearl Harbor?
In the fall, we focused on agriculture heritage for Wayne County. And I looked at the 1940 U.S. Census, and at that time, Wayne County was considered over half of farm rural population, the significance of any community are its people and experiences. And so I knew that the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor was coming up, so it just seemed to kind of fit. So what we came up with was, our focus was how the beginning of the Second World War and how major international events impacted families close to home.
How long did it take to do all of your research to get your information together for this presentation, Marty?
Well, what I did is I started out looking at the microfilm of the Goldsboro News Argus newspaper a few days prior to the attack. Then on December 7th and 8th, I wanted to get a sense of how it was covered in the paper. And then I went about a month or two past that, because it took several weeks sometimes, so much chaos going, that it took a while for families to connect. And from there, I was able to find three gentlemen, servicemen, with strong ties to Wayne County that were actually killed in the attack. Then second, we already had a scrapbook that had newspaper clippings from about 1944 of all servicemen from the county. And in those, I was reading through, and several of them, you know, just mentioned that some of their service accomplishments, where they had served, rather, and it mentioned that they had also been at Pearl Harbor during the attack. So then I started putting together a spreadsheet, and I have about 15 guys from Wayne County that were there.
One of the dive bombers got lucky, and apparently one of the bombs went right down the stack and penetrated down into the main battery magazines. When this occurred, of course, it created an explosion and fire in that area, and when this fire reached these magazines, there was a tremendous explosion. As a matter of fact, it was the most terrific explosion that I observed during the entire war, World War II.
There are three men and their backgrounds that you cover in these oral histories. Who were these three men, and what were their lives like?
We're able to acquire three oral history interviews that were done years ago. There's one gentleman named Norwood Teague, who grew up in Goldsboro. He finished high school in 1934. He had gone to North Carolina State University. And after he graduated in 1940, he enlisted in the United States Navy. So he happened to be an ensign on the USS Tennessee. And he was recorded about 10 years ago. So that was one gentleman. There's another gentleman named Gray Singleton. He was a bit older. He enlisted in the Navy in December of 1933 and just happened to be stationed there. He was recorded in 1995. And then the last one was a gentleman named Jim Dixon. He actually grew up in Oklahoma, but in the 1960s, he worked in Goldsboro, and he was interviewed in 1968.
After our ship was sunk and we stopped being hit by the torpedo planes, we were hit by a few dive bombers a little later. We realized there were quite a number of men down below decks that needed help, and we took flashlights and went down below decks, and we helped as many of these people out of there as we possibly could reach.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how many you helped out?
I'd say probably close to 200 people.
In your listening to these interviews, were the subjects seem open about their experiences, and do you think their families ever broached the subject of this December 7th attack?
You know, I think over time, sometimes that heals wounds. Going through something like that was pretty devastating, but I think over time, you know, how the interviews unfold, they acknowledge the importance and significance to share that experience. You know, the world completely changed.
In keeping that story kind of alive and more personal, do you find that the oral history format is a little more personal to you, making the story more personal as opposed to reading letters or other written statements from subjects?
Well, they both can be, it's how it's presented and put together. They both can be, very powerful. But one thing I really do like about oral history is the voice. And it's even more poignant and powerful, in my opinion, when someone has passed away. You know, when you have an actual recollection and you can hear this voice of a firsthand witness is pretty significant.
Overall, what did you learn about the subjects not only of these men, but of Pearl Harbor in general? What was your learning experience?
I'm always looking for the wow factor and trying to find the stuff that people don't know much about and looking for the bigger picture, how Wayne County fits into these big international events. So that was pretty enlightening, to learn that three guys from here were actually killed in the attack. In this modern era, if someone hears the term Pearl Harbor, they know there was an attack. But when you start revealing the layers and how this bigger picture, how Wayne County families were affected, it's a way to really connect with the local population.
This presentation will be held at the Wayne County Public Library in Goldsboro Wednesday night, December 7th from 7 until 8 p.m., and it is free. For more information, you can check out the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Marty, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Downeast Journal.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the opportunity.
Buying ecstasy is a bargain in some parts of North Carolina. A recent study from Michigan State University stated the average rate for it is less than $4 per tablet in Raleigh and Greensboro, among the cheapest rates in the United States. Because the rates are so low there, the market could expand eastward and into eastern North Carolina. Chris Thomas has more.
Professor Siddharth Chindra of Michigan State University worked with the National Drug Intelligence Center on a series of studies tracking the average price of several narcotics, including ecstasy, a synthetic drug that heightens the senses and causes a short-term surge of dopamine and serotonin levels. According to his findings, the average wholesale price of the drug is $3.50 in two North Carolina towns and $4.75 in South Carolina's capital, Columbia.
And that suggested to us that the Carolinas may be a hot spot for the trafficking of ecstasy as well.
Chindra, an economist, paired probable city-to-city links for ecstasy manufacturing and marketing. His three-year-long study found areas that produce ecstasy tend to have lower prices. Other hotspots are near the Canadian and Mexican border, where ecstasy is also sold at a lower cost.
The drug is very cheap. It's unusually cheap there compared to what it costs in surrounding states and surrounding cities.
Chindra's study focused primarily on ecstasy's prices across the nation, but believes location is still a primary factor.
The Carolinas are probably a point of origin within the United States for the drug, and this raises the question about whether it's a landing point for the drug coming in from overseas, or whether, and we know that ecstasy is a synthetic drug, whether it is being manufactured in that region.
Either is possible. A key ingredient to most varieties of ecstasy, also known as MDMA, is oil from sassafras plants, native to North Carolina, or a replication of it.
We do know that certain countries in Western Europe are major exporters of this drug into the United States. So it could very well be that these are, shipments of the drug are coming into ports in the Carolinas. And so the first cities where we see them, and we see them selling at a really low price, are the ones that are, a few, maybe tens or hundreds of miles away from those port locations.
It's coming into areas like Raleigh and Greensboro, but down the road, those markets may become saturated, and traffickers may expand into eastern North Carolina as a potential market. If that happened, it wouldn't be the first time the region had a strong MDMA presence. Local law enforcement officials say it had its heyday in the early 2000s in its ubiquitous pill form.
It was pretty popular up till probably about 2009, 2010.
Major Chris Thomas of the Onslow County Sheriff's Office.
Well, it's kind of dropped off substantially since that time frame. We don't get it near as much as we used to. Now we probably get the powder form, which is referred to as Molly, more often than we do the ecstasy pills now.
Ecstasy fetches $25 per pill in eastern North Carolina, according to Major Thomas. Higher prices may indicate scarcity and a wide gap between the region and the apparent manufacturing hubs in the Triangle and Triad. Molly, a more potent MDMA substance, demands a higher price, and it's purchased by the gram.
This usually runs between $80 and $100 a gram.
Eastern North Carolina's struggles with methamphetamines and heroin are rampant, well-known, and much higher on priority lists for local vice squads. Ecstasy is more prevalent in larger cities, where underground music and art scenes thrive. Isaac, a Swansboro native, knows that personally.
Once I moved to Atlanta, I became friends with some people who recommended I only do it maybe once every other week just to preserve my chemical balances in my brain. Once every other week, slowly turned to like once a week, and then I had to stop because it was getting too much.
But Isaac got his first taste of MDMA while living in the region. On a camping trip with friends soon after high school, he said there wasn't much else to do in the small community on the Onslow-Carteret County line.
Well, there's sports, I guess, and then drinking. I mean, being so close to the beach, one of the major pastimes was to just go out on the beach and sit in, on the, you know, under the sun all day and have a few beers and just kind of relax, but you know, do that every single day.
Isaac says he hasn't taken ecstasy in about 4 years, in part because the habit became too expensive. He said he spent $20 per week on ecstasy at $10 a tab.
Plus, I moved back, and the availability was much lower in Swansboro.
Data from Chindra didn't include more rural areas of the nation, like eastern North Carolina, but he warns economically depressed areas are more vulnerable to drug trafficking.
For some people, unfortunately, the production of an illegal drug becomes the economic opportunity, right? And that's one reason why sometimes we find, you know, meth labs, and meth is a substance that's closely related to ecstasy, we find them in areas that are economically depressed. So I think there's an economic angle as well. And to the extent that we can, try to counter these phenomena by you know, seeding economic growth or providing opportunities to populations in these areas, I think we could do a lot to combat these epidemics.
He believes seeding economic growth and expanding opportunities to economically disadvantaged areas are an effective way to keep black markets closed. I'm Chris Thomas.
This is Dr. Jim Congleton. I want to wish you a great holiday season, and I want to invite you to look at your plan for your final 2016 philanthropic gifts. I believe a reasonable giving strategy is to support a resource you respect and one that you use, and that would be Public Radio East. You can make your tax-deductible gift through appreciated stocks, credit card, and a multitude of other methods. But make your gift before December 31st, and then break out the champagne.
There's an environmental and economic crisis along our coast and around the world. Oyster populations are drastically low as compared to numbers a century ago. In North Carolina, oyster populations have dropped a whopping 90%. But two men in Carteret County think they may have the answer to the shortage. One is a scientist.
So we get a lot more filtration, biodeposits.
The other is a fisherman.
I do most of my shell fishing in Hushmouth Creek. That's right next to Ain't Telling You Bay.
It's an unlikely partnership, since scientists and commercial fishermen haven't traditionally had the best relationship. Against big odds, these two have worked together for the past 6 years to figure out the best way to increase oyster populations in the estuaries of North Carolina's coast. Waters were once abundant with oysters, but now populations have been decimated because of overharvesting and habitat destruction.
It's also important to note that the environment along our coast has changed dramatically over the years.
Dr. Niels Lindquist is a researcher at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City.
One of those big changes has been to allow more salt water into our estuaries, and dredging inlets and building the intercoastal waterway. And when you change the water and make it saltier, it's harder for oysters because there are so many more predators and pests that love to eat oysters as much as we do.
Oysters are important economically in North Carolina.
According to Dr. Lindquist, the oyster harvest over the past few years has been steady at $250 million. The industry provides local jobs, and the product will be sent to seafood markets and restaurants here locally and internationally. Oysters are also highly valued because of their ability to clean the water. Mollusks have the ability to filter up to 50 gallons of water each day.
The oysters also make reefs along shorelines, and they protect the shorelines from erosion, so they're very important for protecting coastal properties.
Over the past few decades, local scientists and conservationists have developed methods to restore oyster populations. One of the more successful efforts is the creation of man-made oyster shell sills. A pile of loose oyster shells, or marl, is placed in shallow water, creating a barrier that runs parallel to shore. The rock or shell material can also be placed inside mesh bags. Plants can be added around the sill to create a living shoreline. The idea is that oyster larvae will attach to the substrate, and you have an oyster reef. While this is still an effective practice for oyster restoration, Dr. Lindquist called upon the local knowledge of David Clamorhead Cessna, a seventh-generation fisherman in Downeast Carteret County, to improve upon traditional methods. Together, they've experimented with different types of materials to get the most effective way to restore oyster populations.
The imaginations took over, and we came up with a new material that we've been testing now, and it looks very promising for growing oysters, and then having those oysters on a material that allows us to do a lot of different things with them.
Their improved method for restoration bypasses marl and oyster shells and instead uses an ephemeral plant-based material to create structures for oyster larvae to attach to. Clamorhead, who left his job in construction to return to his love of fishing, is using his building skills to create reefs.
This new material that we've created is basically a plant fiber with certain cement binders.
The plant-based reef material can be molded into different shapes and sizes, from flat square mats to long rod shapes, pyramids, and something that he refers to as a cow patty.
Just a big pile of string all weaved around together with this binder on it that have turned out to be our very, very productive product.
This dynamic duo has tested new material and a variety of reef shapes behind the Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City. The site is located on the busy Bogue Sound Waterway, which is exposed to strong southwest winds and frequent yacht wakes 3 to 4 feet high. Dr. Lindquist says their method is showing marked improvements over traditional oyster sills.
And we create reefs that can withstand tremendous wave and currents. And we've had material in the water for almost 10 months now, and we've seen it not move an inch and grow fabulous oyster populations where an oyster sill just down the beach from us has been pushed back by boat wakes and strong waves.
There are several advantages to using this new method to build oyster reefs over traditional methods. If oysters fail to grow and cover the mesh bags, they eventually tear open and the shells scatter and the plastic ends up in the environment. However, the new biodegradable substrate material eventually disintegrates in the water and the concrete crumbles into small pieces and becomes part of the sediment bed. Another benefit has to do with the way the reefs are designed. Each three-dimensional structure is elevated above the bottom. Since it isn't submerged in sand, Clamorhead says oyster larvae can settle on all sides of the substrate. This results in more oysters, which means more filtration, which leads to healthier waterways and a more prosperous fishing industry.
When and build an oyster seal out of a solid pile, then you've just got that surface area. Nothing lives underneath it. Nothing lives in it, or little to nothing. But with our method, we usually start 6 to 12 inches above ground level, in some cases even higher, to catch the intertidal zone, so that by the time we actually start catching oyster larvae, we've already got fish swimming around underneath it. We've got crabs crawling through it.
In addition to creating microhabitats, another advantage of these rigid structures is that they can be anchored in place in intertidal areas with strong waves and currents. Dr. Lindquist explains more water movement carries more food to the reef, resulting in faster growing oysters.
It was typically said that it would take 18 to 24 months to grow an oyster to market size, and that's growing them up in the water column in these bags that everybody assumes is the best and the fastest way to grow an oyster.
Dr. Lindquist says they have been able to cut that time by almost half, growing market-sized, high-quality oysters in only about 12 to 15 months. The scientist and the fishermen leased another testing site in the Newport River, an intertidal area where a small portion of the 1.3 acres was covered with the substrate. Their conservative estimate is that 3.6 million oysters have grown at the site, though it's probably more like 5 to 6 million. And that brings up another interesting point with this new method. Before the reefs were placed in that leased area, oysters did not exist there. It was just sand. These reefs can be used to create thriving oyster habitats in places where they didn't previously exist. Dr. Lindquist hopes the new material and the methods they've found for growing oysters will create opportunity for conservationists and even waterfront homeowners who want to create a living shoreline in their own backyard.
We're also working with the Division of Marine Fisheries and talking about ways in which we can use the oysters growing on our substrates to help with restoration activities and also with culch planting and enhancing the resource for commercial and recreational fishermen from wild oyster populations.
Word about the new oyster reefs has circulated around the fishing community down east. Clammerhead says some of his friends are interested in being a part of it.
They see it as a way of making a decent income, a way of helping the environment, still getting to be out on the water and maintain that commercial fishing individuality.
In the past, the relationship between scientists and commercial fishermen has been strained. But Clammerhead says this project has proven that scientists and fishermen can work together. And when they do, magic happens.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. I'm now accepting applications for my Master Gardener Volunteer Training Program, and every time I do this, I'm asked a lot of questions and have to clear up some misconceptions about this program. Since there are 86 Master Gardener Volunteer Programs in North Carolina, that's one in most counties, this is a great opportunity and resource for all of our listeners to be aware of. First, Master Gardener Volunteers are gardeners who want to learn more about growing plants and to share that knowledge back with their communities. Master Gardener Volunteers receive extensive training, and in exchange, they volunteer their knowledge and expertise to the gardening public in their county. Master Gardener Volunteers share locally appropriate, research-based information. If you are accepted into your county's Master Gardener Volunteer Training Program, you will attend the training course. This course is a lot of fun. It's taught by Extension staff, local experts, and experienced Master Gardener volunteers. The program offers a minimum of 40 hours of instruction and covers a wide variety of topics, from lawns, trees, and shrubs, to insects, diseases, and weed management, to vegetable gardening, home fruit production, garden flowers, water conservation, composting, and more. Class members receive a comprehensive Master Gardener Volunteer Manual as well. Once you've completed the training program and fulfilled your particular program's requirements, Master Gardener Volunteers begin a volunteer internship, volunteering alongside more experienced Master Gardeners. They often assist with the development, upkeep, and education at demonstration and community gardens. In many counties, volunteers staff a call line or plant clinic where the public can call or walk in with their gardening questions. Master Gardener volunteers help diagnose and answer the plant, insect, and disease problems that come in. They also assist in teaching community classes, classes to children and senior adults, and lecture on gardening topics that are of particular interest to them. Each county accepts applications for their Master Gardener Volunteer Program on their own deadline, but since many programs are run in the spring, most counties will be taking applications now. You can find out if your county has a Master Gardener Volunteer Program by visiting ncstategardening.org. Even if you have no interest in becoming a volunteer yourself, you will want to reach out to your county's Master Gardener group. These volunteers are a wealth of information and can help you understand what's going on in your garden, help diagnose insect or disease problems, or identify an unknown plant, and a whole lot more. So check out all the great resources that your county's Master Gardener Volunteer Program has to offer. And if it's a good fit for you, consider becoming a Master Gardener Volunteer yourself.
Here's an event happening this Saturday to get you in the holiday spirit. The 31st Annual Coastal Christmas Flotilla takes place in downtown New Bern.
My name is Nicole Dewar, New Bern Parks and Recreation. It is a boat parade that started in New Bern, and it's just become a huge tradition, and it's one that we continue today. We have power boats, we have sailboats, we have smaller boats. We've even had Hatteras a couple times has put in one of their big yachts. We've had a little John boat one year, so we never know year to year what we're going to get. It's always, like Forrest Gump says, it's like a box of chocolates. Santa Claus is actually going to be arriving by boat, and he will dock there at Union Point Park, and he will go under the gazebo and greet the kids. It is this Saturday, December 3rd, and the best place for viewing is going to be at Union Point Park. The Marine Corps Band from Cherry Point is going to start playing at 4 o'clock, and they'll play for about an hour, and then the boats will come in around 5. For more information on this nonprofit event, go to publicradioeast.org. Event calendar.